And welcome back. About an hour from right now, we'll be taking your calls, the Hour of Openness. I made a few revelations earlier this week. I don't like horror movies. I'm not a big fan of that. I like roller coasters. I don't know. Does that make me weird? We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll hear about your thoughts on The Hunt. On The Hunt, why? Well, because we're going to talk to Bill Mills, and a majority of the folks who voted on a plebiscite in the town of Truro says, yes, we have a deer problem, and we want to authorize or at least see a bow or crossbow hunt to control and reduce the urban deer population. We'll talk about that. Also on the show, the director of the David Sobey Center for Innovation in Retailing and Services. What do the numbers say? What does research say? Well, the impact on business due to the pandemic. We're also going to talk about rent control with the community legal worker with Dalhousie Legal Aid in a few moments. Right now, though, we'll take our focus and place it squarely on our mental health. The Nova Scotia Mental Health page, the Canadian Mental Health Association, how is COVID-19 impacting mental health, coping with COVID-19? We could all use a little help sometimes. It's one of the headlines. And we know yesterday that they held a news conference, they being the official opposition, saying there's a need. It's okay to not be okay. And they've truly made their vision of mental health care an election issue moving forward. Access to mental health care, they say, is a right, not a privilege, and that mental health care is health care. And access should not be exclusive to those who are fortunate enough to have insurance coverage or who can afford private care. Access should be truly universal. That's what the politicians are saying on the opposition side of the House. Our next guest is, a PhD with research in the health system impact. In fact, one of his works recently talking about mental health, and been a lot of conversation about it. We've had a lot of conversation on this show. And Mark Embritt, how are you today, sir?
Hi, I'm doing very well, Sheldon.
Tell me a little bit more about your area of research.
Certainly, yes. So I'm a health system, health policy researcher right now at Dalhousie University. And one of the areas that I look into are digital solutions for mental health.
You know, when the opposition comes out with a position, you know, ahead of what will be an election at some point in the next 2 years, but in the midst of a pandemic, you know, we all seem to be talking a lot about this. Do you see that we're doing enough?
No, I don't think so. No, the health system itself hasn't really done enough for people suffering from mental illness for a while. And we see that in a lot of numbers. You know, roughly about 5 million Canadians suffer from a mental health issue, and less than half of them say that they even get somewhat adequate care. And that number has been increasing over the years, as well as the percentage of health spending that goes towards mental health has been going down as a percentage of total mental health or total health spending.
Why do you think there's a challenge to access?
I think, well, there's a lot of different challenges to access. One of it is, I think, resources allocated to mental health. But the other thing is mental health itself has characteristics that kind of influence health-seeking behavior of people. And people often don't want to admit that they have a mental health issue. They don't recognize signs within themselves of mental health issues. Their friends and loved ones might not be educated or aware of what mental health signs of mental health issues are. So they often won't seek care very early on in when they're experiencing some kind of a mental health issue. And then it really becomes worse and worse until oftentimes somebody self-harms or, you know, there's a some kind of event that forces them to seek help. But if mental health and mental illness or mental illness was more easily recognized, people were more comfortable talking about it, then I think it would be much more preventable, like a lot of other medical issues.
What you're describing there is quite different than stigma.
Yeah, it's not only, stigma is a big issue. People, and that's also, research bears that out, that people don't want to be embarrassed by their mental illness symptoms. They don't want people to think that they're making it up or it's all in their head or they can just get over it. So stigma is certainly part of it, but it's not the whole thing.
You talked about how some mental illness prevents people from seeking out mental care, mental health care. And that's a fascinating way to look at it, because I've heard it also described from the other side, which is we really do have a system that waits until you're sick enough to be treated. The small, and I won't call them small, I'll call them the early signs, sometimes aren't enough to trigger the system, and it takes a major event. So how do we square those things?
There's a variety of options that are available. And one of the more recent research studies that I've done is the opportunity for governments to adopt more digital solutions for mental health. So and as I mentioned before about the kind of health-seeking behavior of individuals and how mental illness can inhibit health-seeking behavior or like stop people from admitting to face-to-face situations to other people that they have mental health. Digital solutions, things like online peer support, online chat, even there's chat bots, which are artificially intelligent kind of bots that you can chat with that are trained or the algorithm for them provides them to respond in a cognitive behavioral therapy manner. So like it helps you try to change the way that you're thinking about your behavior. Those are kind of options of low threshold barrier services that individuals might be able to use that does kind of avoid having, at least initially, having to have that face-to-face conversation with a friend or a GP just trying to access some kind of mental health service. And in that way, individuals are able to become more educated about their symptoms. And this is what we call mental health literacy, where individuals are actually able to recognize not only symptoms in themselves, but symptoms in others, and are able to kind of communicate what they're seeing better. And I think those are some ways that we can kind of try to overcome that initial barrier to accessing the system.
Again, our guest today is Mark, and you do say Embrett. Is that how you pronounce it?
The same open.
That's correct.
He is joining us here to talk with us about some of the research he's been doing. I spoke on the show last week about one of the challenges, and this was with the Association of Social Workers, is that, and this was, I think, part of the thrust of the PC or the opposition party's announcement this week, and I'm not trying to politicize our conversation here this afternoon, but that if you are employed and you have a medical plan, you know, your ability to access mental care, mental health care is somewhat easier through employee assistant programs or even referrals to mental health professionals. Whereas if you are working a minimum wage job or you're not employed, you're in that world, that's not easily accessible, and that most of the mental health care is provided by family doctors. And here I just mentioned 52,000 Nova Scotians don't even have access to a family doctor. When you say mental health could help, the health system has started down that path. Has your research taken into account or looked at some of the efficacy, how effective it has been?
Sheldon, a lot of these digital or mental health solutions are privatized solutions that really have intellectual property issues where most governments aren't able, or researchers like myself aren't able to kind of get at the guts of the what data they're collecting, how effective these services are. They are often, if not all, kind of very low risk solutions. Solutions. But whether or not how effective they're working is questionable. And I think in my paper, what I'm we'll call the action that I'm trying to make is that governments, because the private industry, I think in 2013, there was about $2.8 billion spent on digital mental health services. Now it's like $28 billion a year. And we're not really understanding how effective these things are. And with the proliferation of kind of attention drawing social media apps, we need to make sure that these apps aren't doing something similar to that, where it's more of just a, and they have addictive properties and maybe even contributing to a problem. Hmm. So governments need to create or should be creating something that's, that assesses these services, kind of like I would draw the comparison to how pharmaceuticals are evaluated. So a company creates a drug, submits it to Health Canada, they evaluate whether it's effective, whether it's safe, and then they allow the provinces to purchase it, and the provinces can negotiate drug prices. Something like that would be effective for these digital mental health solutions, where companies have to be transparent in whether or not they work. But right now it's an unregulated service, and who knows exactly what the experiences of a lot of these people using these services are. The underlying theory of them is effective, mm-hmm. Such as cognitive behavioral therapy, peer support, things like that. But we don't know exactly individually which ones are more effective than others.
So some of these systems you're saying are being created so that people can say they've created the system, not so much, not to say that they're not interested in patient outcome, but that's not the number one goal?
Exactly, yeah, because they are a private industry, yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, I think we've just kind of scratched the surface of this conversation, and that's why you're looking at a doctorate in this. I want to thank you, Mark, for giving us some guidance here. Yes?
I do have my doctorate.
Oh, you do have your, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Absolutely, you earned that. And okay, Dr. Mark Amber, thank you then for helping us.
Thank you, Sheldon.
I do appreciate this.
Yep. Happy to discuss it anytime.
You take care. Take care.
Thanks.
A PhD in mental health services and looking at systems. Thank you, Dr. Embritt. And, you know, it's his title, and I apologize if I mistakenly refer to the fact that he didn't, but he does. And if you or someone you know is looking to find some support, obviously, in the case of an emergency, call 911 or visit your local emergency room. And there is a mobile health crisis team. We've spoken to them on this show, and that number, if you're interested, is 402-429-8167. We're going to take a break, and in just a few moments, we're going to hear from the director of the David Sobey Center for Innovation in Retailing and Services and talk about not just the National Retail Awards, but the impact on retailers this pandemic has had. We'll be right back. Well, I know more than a few of you saw the letter. It's making its rounds on social media, and it was sent to the tenants at a building on Dutch Village Road, and it says that they're doing some massive renovations, some massive interruptions, and there is a massive increase in rent coming. In fact, up by $650 a month. Well, they do offer, though, find some new rental accommodations, and that you can leave, you can vacate without notice, and your damage deposit will be returned in full. Provided it happens by the end of November. What does all this mean? Let's get to Mark Culligan. And Mark Culligan is a community legal worker with Dalhousie Legal Aid Service. And good day to you, Mark. I assume you've been following some of the stories about this one person in particular who says this is like a 90% increase to her rent.
Good afternoon. Yes, I have been following this story. And unfortunately, a number of other people have called from the same building over the last year with similar accounts as well.
What does this say about the system that's in place that a 90% rent increase can be announced? And, you know, obviously, I did acknowledge that the owners of the building did allow people to break their lease or their current rental agreement without penalty.
Well, we take the view that this case really shows the need for rent control in Nova Scotia. BC, Ontario, Quebec, PEI, Manitoba, all these other provinces have rent control, which limits the amount of a rent increase. And this situation really shows the urgent need for similar legislation here in Nova Scotia.
When contacted, the folks involved with the ownership, the development company said that this unit needs major work on the water pipes and that they need people to leave and that it's not about the rent increase. It says they have no choice. We're just trying to vacate the unit.
So there's a proper procedure to do that under the Residential Tenancies Act. That's to apply to the Director of Residential Tenancies for a notice of vacant possession to accommodate a renovation so extensive as to require a building permit. Why the landlord did not do that in this case, I don't know. But certainly the proper procedure is not to simply increase the rent to such an extent as to force people to get out.
Renoviction has entered our vernacular. Does this kind of smack of that?
It certainly does. And unfortunately, this is an all too common story. We are seeing this throughout the Halifax metropolitan area and certainly in the Fairview neighborhood where this is an intense process right now.
What do you say to people who are suggesting, you know what, there's a lot of construction happening and, you know, people are looking to improve or upgrade the amenities within these buildings or old, tired, or perhaps in need of this work that, you know, this has to happen and it comes at a cost?
So what I would say is that in provinces where they do have rent control legislation, a landlord can increase the rent, but they have to show that they've actually done the repairs or renovations to a unit which justify that rent increase. What we've heard from this landlord is, in their interview with CTV, is that they're not increasing this in order to cover the cost of those renovations, but increasing the rent in order to try to get the tenant to leave. And that's a totally different ballgame. That's trying to bypass the Residential Tenancies Act by jacking up the rent. So there are processes for doing this, and in Nova Scotia, it's a shame that we haven't required landlords to justify rent increases like landlords are required to do so in jurisdictions where there is rent control.
You know, we have to acknowledge that it is a peninsula. No new land is obviously being built. Well, I guess they can infill some of the harbor, and they've done so. But, you know, this was the other quote from one of the people involved saying that there's no land available, so they have to upgrade, and with upgrade comes a need to get a return on investment.
So units need to be upgraded. There's no question of that. The problem is that right now rent increases aren't regulated. So we don't have any way to tell if these upgrades are in line with the actual costs of upgrading them or if they're money grabs. Hmm. As I said earlier, I think this is a case where some questions are definitely needed to be raised about the actual costs of the renovations.
So where should that be raised? Should it be in front of the tenancy board? Should it be in a court of law?
Well, right now there is no rent control in Nova Scotia. That was a decision that was taken by the Liberal government in 1993 at a time when the vacancy rate was 7% on the peninsula and 12% in Dartmouth. For several years now, it's been 1% in both of those areas, and so we have a new economic conditions that call for a different legislative regime. So we need to have rent control in Nova Scotia so that these kinds of questions can be addressed through a decision-making body that's set up to deal with it.
Hmm. And when you say rent control, would it look like, you know, no more than a percentage increase? I think Toronto, it's a 2%. They're capped at about a 2% annual increase.
Yeah, so most jurisdictions have a cap for how much it can be increased. But you can go over that cap if you can show that you've actually done repairs or renovations.
But there's a process.
Yeah, and you have to demonstrate that you've actually put in those improvements.
Right. We will obviously look to find out what other politicians. I did ask Labby Kasulis, who's running for the leadership of the party, and he does acknowledge that affordable housing is something he wants to discuss, but it's layered. It involves many moving parts, but clearly there are people struggling and who will struggle even more if they are facing what might effectively be a 90% increase to their rent.
So what I would say is that kind of answer is no longer acceptable. This is not a new issue. This has been going on for years, and we've been hearing that same old, I'll listen and think about it. That's no longer good enough. This is happening right now to this poor person in the riding of the current Minister for Residential Tenancies, Patricia Arup. And I call on her to finally take action to reintroduce rent control.
Mark Culligan, thank you for this. I really do appreciate having your attendance and participation.
Thank you.
He is Mark Culligan, a community legal worker with Dalhousie Legal Aid Service. Perhaps something for us to take up part of our hour of openness coming up between 2 and 3. We're heading into the break, and this is the opportunity for me to say, whoops, I teed up the wrong guest. We'll hear from Dr. Ramesh Venkat coming up after the 1:30 news from Sky. He's the director of the David Sobey Center for Innovation in Retailing and Services. Alrighty. I see Halifax Cycling has tweeted out this afternoon a collision this morning happened at the intersection of Quinpool Road and Vernon Street, one of HRM's local street bikeways and part of the All Ages and Abilities or AAA Cycling Network. Better infrastructure is needed at this intersection, say they. And then someone else retweeted to say, if anyone has any footage of this accident, let them know. The victim in this case got the ticket, so they're taking this up, something that happened just a few weeks ago. Welcome back. It's the second hour of the Sheldon McLeod Show here on News 95.7. I'm Sheldon. That's Katie Hartai over on the other side of the glass, helping us out as producer. She'll be taking your calls, and we open the phones at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Had somebody tweet at me earlier this hour that they love horror movies but hate roller coasters. Thanks, Sean. I put up a Twitter poll if you want to weigh in there. It's at the S. McLeod Show. We're going to be chatting with the mayor of Truro in just a few moments, Bill Mills. He's going to share with us his thoughts on election night and the plebiscite, asking residents whether or not they support managed hunt to control the deer population in within the Truro town limits. That's coming up in a few moments. But as mentioned, we are going to be chatting right now about this upcoming, conversation, the impact the pandemic has had on retailers, and, also some retail awards. So we'll talk about those two things with Dr. Ramesh. Dr. Ramesh, is it Venkat?
Yes.
Thank you very much for joining us, Doctor.
Thanks for having me, Sheldon.
You're the director of the David Sobey Center for Innovation in Retailing and Services. So what can you discuss with us? What can you tell us about what you know on the impact this pandemic has had on retailers? I think we've been hearing quite a bit of it in the news. Is there research yet?
Yes. Over the summer, actually, we've talked to over 30 retail companies, big and small, multinational to local companies, to understand impact firsthand and how they are dealing with the pandemic and what their plans are for the future. And it's had, different kinds of impacts, but mainly financial impact on a lot of retailers, both in Canada and U.S. There's a number of retailers that are under bankruptcy protection right now because, as you know, during the lockdown period, a lot of them had to shut down. And they were all in a cash crunch, and so they are feeling the effects of that now. So it's going to be a slow recovery for a lot of them. And when they come back, they're probably going to be a smaller retailer than before. Mm-hmm. So that is something that we are certainly seeing. And some of the jobs that have been lost probably will not come back because a lot of the retailers are going to be downsizing.
So what do you make of the fact that there were record profits by major corporations and companies like Amazon? The grocery retailers did very well. Some of the larger retailers did very well. But yet some of the smaller corner operator family-run businesses found challenges that, for the most part, seems to be the evidence of record.
Yeah, that's exactly true. The grocery retailers were in a very sort of fortunate situation as we were in a lockdown mode and restaurants were closed. Everybody was cooking and baking at home, and so they certainly benefited from that. And Amazon and many other online retailers also benefited because, people were not going out to shop and malls were closed. And so, we ended up buying a lot more online. Online purchasing more than doubled here in Canada. Even in a category like groceries, where online purchasing was only about 2.5% of the total grocery spend before the pandemic, we heard in our surveys that 25% of consumers have done online grocery shopping in the last few months. So anybody that was well-equipped to take orders and deliver online did quite well.
Yeah, and again, much of this we've heard about. And are you able to, and maybe it's too soon to know, how those companies that were able to navigate, the smaller companies, the fact that they were able to, either pivot production or change their product, how it was that they were able to succeed?
Yeah, the ones that struggled, certainly, when malls closed, we talked to a number of smaller retailers, and some of the landlords were not, very flexible. And so they had to pay rent while the stores were closed. And so that caused a lot of financial difficulty to some of the smaller retailers. But then many others, as you pointed out, they certainly pivoted in really interesting ways. They started selling products that they previously would not have sold. We heard from a pharmacy, small pharmacy retailer that sold a sporting equipment, that sort of thing, because people were buying that. So people were certainly pivoting. And then the companies that are getting the awards this afternoon from us, they all innovated in different ways. A company that makes women's intimate apparel, they quickly launched a virtual fitting room where you could go and try the product, online. And because that's the product where people probably, would want to be in the store to see the product. But online, the company was able to create a solution that seemed to work for them. Mm-hmm. So I think the companies that were innovative, that tried new things, succeeded.
Mm-hmm. He is the director at the David Sobey Center for Innovation in Retailing and Services. Dr. Ramesh Venkat is our guest. As you said, and as we will know later today, that through the retailing and services at St. Mary's University, your center, there will be some awards, but you've pivoted. You had to change your awards somewhat. You've had to adjust the categories.
Right. So, usually we obviously do these awards, in a nice environment, face to face. But this year, it's all happening virtually. So we have companies from Vancouver and Toronto that are getting awards, but we focused at least two of the categories on how the retailers responded to the pandemic. So the company that I mentioned, Nix, which is the women's intimate apparel company, is one of the companies that is getting the award, and the other one, Vessi Footwear. Is getting an award for the really remarkable community service that they've done during this time. They have donated over 2,000 pairs of shoes to healthcare workers, and they created a massive program for giving away masks on a save-what-you-can sort of model. Mm-hmm. And they, for a small business that's only 2 years old, to kind of step up in that manner to contribute to the community, we thought was deserving of an award.
I'm curious if there are any, is there any way to really know or understand what it will be like once this is over? Does there exist a model? Can we look back to the Spanish flu pandemic and there were lockdowns then, but the world was a different place almost 100 years ago, clearly.
That's right. I mean, 100 years ago, it's a completely different world now. But, we've been surveying Canadians, from April. So we did a survey every month as the pandemic evolved to try and understand consumer behavior and how that was changing. And what we have found is that some of the behaviors that have changed are probably going to stick. More and more people are comfortable shopping online for categories where they did not buy online, like food and furniture and things like that. So I think you're going to see some of that sticking. And so there's going to be a surge in online spending that you're going to see that's going to stay. And people are saying that, the pandemic, at least a segment of the population, it's not everybody. They're saying that, this has caused them to sort of rethink, their purpose in life and, what they would like to do. And it's not so much about just buying products. It's more about relationships and, really meaningful experiences in life, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So you're going to find a segment of the population that's probably going to consume in a different way than they did before.
Well, and again, we'll certainly have to find out, and we'll be looking to the researchers who will be tracking and then analyzing all of this data over the next year or more. Again, not knowing when this is all going to come to fruition. Dr. Ramesh Venkat, thank you very much for helping us with this information this afternoon. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You take care. From St. Mary's University, he's the director of the David Sobey Center for Innovation in Retailing and Services here this afternoon. I was thinking of working on a little project at home, and I'm a handy person, and I went online to see where I might be able to find some items. I don't tend to order online. I like to shop. I like to be able to look at it before I buy it. But that's getting more and more challenging. That's more of a challenge with some delays in getting things shipped in. I hearing about the challenges of trying to get appliances right now. If your stove breaks down, how much trouble you're going to have trying to get a replacement. And you know, we're in this world. It's a weird place where, you know, you can call somebody, and I won't name names, but Boss Dan was saying it was taking a long time to get his stove fixed, his oven fixed. And you know what? Even ordering a new one's going to take you a whole lot of time. And I see people all the time on the South Shore who are frustrated. They want to shop local, but they can't find what they're looking for. Or they say the price isn't competitive. But with all these other costs associated with retail, with the cleaning and the barriers and, you know, the staff training, all of that, I can understand why people might be kind of reluctant. And, you know, if you're all about yourself, looking out for your own pocketbook, why it might make sense to say, I can save a couple bucks. Why wouldn't I? There are other costs. Kind of hard to factor it all in, isn't it? We're going to take a break, and in just a few moments, I've said on the show, I grew up in a family that were very interested in being outside. Saw this video with a guy. He's got a Netflix show about hunting and fishing. And he was describing in this discussion, this talk, about how he grew up with a love and appreciation with nature. But he also says he hunts and fishes. And he says for some people, that seems to be a contradiction. I know Katie has some opinions about that. You probably do too. The mayor of Truro, Bill Mills, is going to tell us about his thoughts. He was really sure that the decision to hold a deer hunt within town limits in Truro was going to be very close. The decision, the plebiscite from October 17th. So we're going to talk about that with Mayor Bill Mills, re-elect Bill Mills in just a few moments. We'll be right back. Well, as the electorate across the province went to vote in mayors and councillors across Nova Scotia, there was another question on the ballot within Truro's catchment area, and that question had to do with whether or not residents there supported an urban deer hunt. And first and foremost, we want to welcome Truro's mayor back to the airwaves. And Bill Mills, I knew you back when you were a councillor, and you've been a mayor for a long time. Congratulations on re-election.
Thank you very much, Sheldon. It's a pleasure to be here today.
How many years of mayor now?
23.
Wow. I've known you for that long. you won by a large margin. I remember, the issue of the deer within the town limits a couple of years ago. There were information sessions being held. In fact, I ran across a story from the radio station there saying that, you know, people lined out the door at the Truro Community Hall, the fire hall, to talk about this issue. A couple of issues were on the table, you know, 12 mm-hmm. different options. How did you land on this one, and why is this now such an issue within your community?
Well, again, as I said in previous broadcast, I thought the vote would be closer than what it was. Basically, there was a difference of 583, about 24% between the yes and the no's in favor of yes. So that was a surprise to me. I guess it's an indication that people are now is beyond the cute stage where deer are feeding and doing their activities in our backyards and front yards and so on. So people are starting to really be annoyed by some of the things that are going on. Also, the issue of Lyme disease and ticks has started to rise up, not only in Truro, but across the province. And so I think there are some concerns there as well. So anyway, the plebiscite was had. I might add it's non-binding, but certainly we have a fair indication of the attitude and climate of citizens in Truro. So that's how we got from there to here.
You say it was non-binding. Was that clear on the ballot?
No, I think most plebiscites are. The position we find ourselves in right now is that we've lost four members of our previous council. So obviously we have four new members. And certainly we need to have the debate with them. I know one new member is in favor of doing something with the deer, but in a humane manner. And we agree with that. But how humane and what does that mean? So we need to sit down and have that discussion. So as I said during the campaign, I tried as best I could to assure residents that after the results were in on election night, at 9 o'clock, we do not have 100 people lined up in Jeeps and ready to go with AK-47s and away they were going to go to get the deer. This is going to require some further discussion and also we will have to consult with Lands and Forests. And also, we have some studies that, coincidentally, one was just given to me today, which was conducted over the past year, and the results were printed August 2020. I got my copy today, and this is from Mount Allison University by a young student by the name of Michael Nolan. It's on wildlife management, the prevention of tick vector infections, and so that's good. Then there's an integrated approach for managing white-tailed deer in suburban environments. This is a study from Cornell University, and I received that today from one of my other newly elected counselors, who coincidentally former Deputy Chief of Police, Jim Fleming. And so he has some rather strong feelings on humane dealing with the deer and the hunt. So we're obviously going to have this discussion, and talking to my CAO this morning, you know, likely there's not going to be something happen on a greater scale than what we've done in the past. We'll still do the hunt on the upper areas of the watershed, but this new hunt that we're talking about now likely won't get off the ground till next fall.
Bill Mills is the mayor of Truro, mayor-elect, and you know, you said that there were previous hunts. How can you, just for the sake of our listeners, help us understand how big a challenge, what a big problem this is? In fact, you know, when you see a majority of the people voting in this plebiscite to do something about it, they identify it as a problem. So can you kind of paint a picture for us?
Well, again, we've been dealing with this for 6 or 7 years. So I don't think anybody can accuse us of trying to rush in blindly. We've consulted with Lands and Forests. We have carried out all the suggestions that they have given to us, in particular the idea of a pellet count to measure where the deer are traveling. And this past year, the count has gone up 79% over where it was last year. So, of course, that indicates a greater population per capita of deer than just about anywhere else in the province. So that's concerning. The Lyme disease issue, certainly that grows in concern with our residents. And then there are other things as traffic accidents, deer running out and cars hitting them, trucks hitting them. And when you stop and think about it for a second, when a deer is injured as a result of an accident, it usually runs somewhere just slightly off the road or behind an apartment building and suffers. And so we need to deal with that. So when you bring our police officers in the picture and they have to put down a deer in close proximity to a residence, that's not a popular thing to do. And it can be very disturbing to the members of the household. So all of these things added up have brought us to where we are today. So again, I know that my member of parliament, who is a resident of Truro, has been putting a lot of things on Facebook in really strong opposition to a deer hunt, fears, for example, of a bow hunt taking place and a deer being shot and then eventually walking around town with a deer perhaps still in it, but the deer is still alive walking through the street. So, yeah, we understand that. We get it. But that's why it's important for us to get this thing right. And we can't do that without Lands and Forests and other experts in that field.
Right. So as you say, if it happens, if there is a call, it won't be this season. What can you offer us as far as perhaps some of the other alternatives that are being suggested? What other things are people saying instead of killing the deer to control their population?
Well, we've had a number of them, and this study that I have from Cornell University outlines a number of them, but, you know, blanketing sort of a group of deer with a net and catching them that way, I guess on paper it sounds good, but when you do catch them and then move them to another location, there's a certain amount of shock that the deer will be in, and I know a number of years ago on Christmas Eve here in Truro, there was a deer stuck in an area between two buildings, and one end was fenced off, and the other end, very minute coverage for a deer to get through. So he was trapped, and I remember looking at the deer and was in a real sweat. And I asked somebody why he'd be sweating. I guess the obvious answer, he's trying to get out. The second answer was, well, he went into shock. Hmm. And so that deer, unfortunately, didn't fare that well. But, you know, this is a sensitive issue. We're dealing with animals, and they can be stressed quite easily. And so we need to be very careful. And so the issue comes down to, do you want them to be under stress for a long period of time, or do you want this to be swift and to the point and quick? So those are the issues that we're going to have to deal with. Fertilization, well, we've talked about that, contraception, if you will, and that costs about $50 a pop, and that would be with a syringe that would be applied to the deer, either by some kind of a device like a gun, if you will, or if you catch them in a net, then you would give them the sterilization needle there. The only problem with that one, it takes about a year for that to take effect. Hmm. So it can be very costly. And the good news is if a deer is sterilized, it's tagged as well. So you can monitor the movement of this deer and so on and so forth. So in my view, it'd be very good if we had a system where we could go after the bucks. They're the real culprits. And certainly that to me would be something that would be less of number of deer being culled, if you will, than going after the does and the fawns.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know this, we're just about out of time, and just for the clarification again, if there is a hunt, crossbow and or bow hunt, the people who harvest it, they would keep the meat, or they would donate it to a food bank?
That's our plan. I mean, my understanding is that you wouldn't be getting deer steak or anything like that. It all has to be done in hamburger, and it would have to be labeled as such, and that would have to go through the province of Nova Scotia, I'm sure, before we would do that. So some people might find that repulsive, others not so much. And yeah. So, again, that's one of the things that will have to be discussed in depth.
Right. Well, Truro Mayor Bill Mills, thank you for joining the show this afternoon. It sounds like you've got quite a bit of work ahead with your new council on this issue.
We do. Any advice you can offer, I appreciate it.
We'll throw that out to our listeners right now. Bill Mills, thank you, sir. We'll chat again. And again, congratulations to you.
Thank you very much, Sheldon. Have a good day.
You too. He is the mayor of Truro for the last 23 years and says, have you got a solution? Maybe you do. Because you know what? Deer sausage is delicious if you're into it. 902-405-6000. The phone lines are going to be opened up in just moments. And we'll be back with our hour of openness here on News 95.7.